Hello, and welcome to the Archimedes podcast from the Archives of Diseases of Childhood. This is the best podcast you're listening to at this moment in time, dealing with evidence-based practice when it comes to children and child health. What do we do on this podcast? Well, mostly we talk about the issue of Archimedes that is in the journal this month. And Archimedes is a section that we dedicate to rapid but systematic reviews of the best clinical literature to answer a particular patient's problem. How do they get created? Through brilliance, through academic endeavour, and through the peer review process. So, maybe you're dealing with a patient or you have a problem that keeps coming up with a series of patients and you think, is this really the best way we can do it? Is there something else, some more information, something that out there in the literature might be able to help us practice in a way that is more precise, more informed, or just to confirm that what we're doing that doesn't seem to be working is still the best that's out there? Formulate that problem into a structured clinical question, often around the patient and their problem, intervention, comparison, and the major outcomes that are of importance to them, or the PICO frame. Then go away, use those electronic searching skills that you've got to pull out what might be the right answers. Go through them, shuffle out those that could be potentially answering that question and use a quality filter on them, trying to pick out the best that's there. Summarise them using the handy table that we have off the website on our template, and then you can come up with a conclusion. And at the bottom line, what do you do in clinical practice? Now, this is not the opportunity for you to go, more research is needed, because almost always more research is needed. But whilst that's being put together, what does the clinician, yourself, your friends, the people you don't like, what did they do in practice whilst that's happening? So we want clinical bottom lines that come out of it. The other thing that we do in the Archimedes podcast is think about the nature of EBMing. And that's what we're going to do now. How we detect the adverse consequences of our actions remains a challenge in practice. If we think about how we could attempt that within the setting of evidence-based medicine, that is, to have a degree of confidence that an unwanted outcome has been caused by a new treatment or by an action that we've undertaken, it's really hard. Lots of parts come into play with this. First is the frequency of adverse events, because often they happen either really, really uncommonly, like an intracerebral thrombosis, or they happen super commonly, like rash or diarrhea. The rare ones are rare, so they're difficult to spot. The common ones are always happening, so it's unclear if the amount of always that we're seeing is the same as what used to occur in the past. And then, there's if we're looking at clinical trials to try and get this information, adverse events only tend to get collected and reported if they fall into the serious category. And most ways of defining that include the patient needed to be admitted to hospital. So in some settings, that makes loads of sense, like things like trials of asthma therapies, preventatives. But in others, like the oncology interventions, kids are admitted all the time. And actually, now some of the trials exclude a whole load of expected of these hospitalisation events, adverse events. And then thirdly, on top of that, even if these adverse events are collected, it's very unusual for a paper to publish an extensive list of those things that were attempted to be collected to show how they were or weren't the same between groups or how they didn't happen. There's a sort of an within-study publication bias of this sort of information. And in the past, has been thought of as a type of dishonest spin. And many of us can remember how the things have been hidden up within the use of new medicines, particularly adult practice. And then fourthly, the things that can really upset patients and really upset families, things like extreme lethargy, sleepiness, or menstrual disturbances, they're frequently not studied, not asked about, felt to be too minor sometimes by the families to bring to the doctor's attention because they're not like a medical problem. And so all of these things play together to make it really hard. But there is hope. And I bring methodological hope because the methods of being assessed, even rare effects, are being advanced. And there are people working on how to make this better. There's the change towards patient-centered outcome reporting, and that's being increasingly used and used because people believe in it, not just as some sort of SOP. And data repositories rather than just having what was published in the four or five flimsy bits of actual paper mean that the limits on what could fit into a publication are less problematic. And then you add on to that prospective registration, where a trial or a significant clinical study will actually have written down what it was they were intending to collect, so you can see what the gap between what was reported and what was collected are. There's a great deal of inclusion work going on with patients and public in setting up trials and running forwards with them. And so capturing the key outcomes of importance, not just the outcomes that doctors think are important. And there's some really interesting stuff. If you want to go searching for it, do have a look at the article for references about the use of social media posts where people are describing their experiences with a whole range of treatments. And can we use that? So, like with everything in a way, we need to remain open to listening to our patients, listening to methodologists developing new things and evaluating the studies as best we can. And then, when we're asked, was this something that was caused? Provide a balanced view of what happens and why it happens and how we understand it. Our clinical scenario this month comes from Simona Riccio, Pilugi Marsulio, and Claudia Santoro from the Department of Women's and Children's Health and General and Specialised Surgery at the University of Campania in Naples in Italy. They asked the question, do proton pump inhibitors reduce gastrointestinal complications when starting long-term non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug therapy? So the situation that kicked this off was a series of them, really, but crystallised into a nine-year-old with a diagnosis of JIA needing to start NSAID therapy. And the question being raised, should they start a PPI alongside this in order to reduce the GI adverse events, particularly gastric bleeding and the like? The balance here obviously being that PPIs themselves have a series of adverse events and challenges with them. And what's the balance lie? The team went away and they searched PubMed really quite extensively. They looked at ongoing trials and they pulled everything that they possibly could do. When they got down to it, there wasn't a single pediatric study that was looking at this in the setting of a clinical trial. And so they went away and expanded, trying to see if there was something that could be extrapolated from the adult literature, looking again in this question. Now, they came down then to find six papers in total from the adult literature that helped us pull things together. These are tricky. Because when you're pulling all of this stuff, you're in a situation where you're drawing from adult evidence in different situations, potentially for different reasons, with different comorbidities, but they're the best we've possibly got. And there's a whole bunch of randomized trials that looked at using different sorts of non-steroidals, sometimes mixed versions, sometimes naproxen alone, sometimes celecoxib, which is more of the selective non-steroidal type ones, to see what's in there. In terms of numbers, we're ranging from anything from just 40 or so patients right the way up to 1,500 or so, and trying to see, does it make a difference? Well, overall, there are some small differences in the rates of ulceration when PPIs are given. But they don't go on and address any more detail things like, has bleeding actually changed? But again, drawing from the adult literature, if somebody is bleeding, then the use of PPIs seems to be of benefit. all of this stuff came really to be thought about intensely, and in adults, the use of PPIs is really pushed down the line of those that are at high risk, which is where these trials are taking place. Older adults over the age of 60, ones with previous ulcer history, previous bleeding or difficulties like that, and in combination with other drugs that would affect bleeding risk or ulceration risk, such as warfarin or steroids or the use of other SSRIs. Not so much that range of acute use in short term. Pulling in extra work from the cohort theories, not an awful lot extra. Pulling together the adult side, the worries and the knowledge of what PPIs can do, the team came up with what seems like a really reasonable overall clinical bottom line. And that's to say that, truthfully, proton pump inhibitors are effective in the highest risk adult groups taking non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs and are indeed used in that situation, but not advised in the lower risk groups, and there is no work directly in children to support the use of PPIs as prophylaxis. And so it's difficult to conclude that we should be doing that in our children, who are overall a low risk group, although potentially there will be children at much higher risk, and those are the ones where the discussion should be ongoing. So, some complicated cognitive stuff to be wondering about as you leave this month's Archimedes and wander out into the wards and clinics thinking, what problems are there in the world that haven't been Archimedes's? And I could add to the evidence by doing a rapid review. If you're feeling those things, then follow the instructions on the website, use our handy template, and get in touch and see if you too can be here on the Archimedes podcast, chatting and explaining what is going on in the world and why we should have a life a little bit easier from the work that you've done. Until next month, we hope you have a lovely time.